Good afternoon. My name is May, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Federal Health Quality and Health IT Landscape Quarterly Update. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I will now turn the conference over to Kathy Pennock, Vice President, Client Management, Premier Informatics. Ma'am, you may begin the conference.
Thank you, May. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our quarterly update call. And as May said, we'll open it up for questions at the end. And I really do encourage you all to ask questions. We have quite a few people with expertise on the call, so think of your questions as we go through the presentation. And now I'd like to introduce our two speakers. First is Danielle Lloyd. She is a senior director with Premier's Advocacy Office. Her specialty is reimbursement, policy, and analysis. And from Booz Allen Hamilton, we have senior associate Nicole Silverman. And with that, I will turn it over to Danielle or
Nicole.
Nicole.
Okay. Hi.
Sorry about that. Couldn't remember who was going first.
Okay.
So, Nicole, it's all yours.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to our second quarterly update on issues relating to quality and health IT. Starting on slide one, we just have the overview of what we've been asked to cover for all of you, and I think the one key piece of information here is that the date for the next presentation will be September 10th. So on slide two, you can see the topics that we're going to review, and we're going to start with the IPPS proposed rule. So slide three just gives you an overview of the key issues in quality and health IT that were mentioned in CMS's proposed inpatient prospective payment system rule. The rule for a fiscal year 2010 will expand the scope of quality reporting, but they're proposing only by four measures, which is kind of a welcome change from last year when I don't remember, it was something like 30 different measures that they threw out there as possible additions. They will also retire one measure. It's actually already been retired and combine two measures. CMS didn't propose this time around to add any hospital-acquired conditions for fiscal year 2010 reporting. And they did discuss, and we'll go into a little detail, they've continued to discuss alternative sources for data, and they talk a little bit about registries and especially direct submission to CMS via EHRs. So moving to slide four, you can see the four NQF endorsed measures that CMS proposed adding to the current set of measures for the fiscal year 2011 payment determination, which means that you start reporting it in fiscal year 2010. And there are two that are chart abstraction, two skip measures, post-op urinary catheter removal on post-op day one or two, and perioperative temperature management. And then there are two structural measures where they're looking at whether your hospital participates in particular registries. So this is similar to the cardiac surgery, or not STS, but the cardiac surgery registry participation question that was added last year. And you just would be yes or no, you get credit even if you're not participating because they're looking just at whether at the reporting and not whether you're participating or not. And the start date for these data submissions is proposed as January 1st, 2010. Then on slide five, there's some information on the two measures that they're proposing to combine or harmonize. And NQF had reviewed these measures, which they do periodically as part of their measure maintenance process, and concluded that they really were substantially similar. And that is from the ARC patient safety indicator set, death among surgical patients with treatable serious complications, and the nursing sensitive measure, failure to rescue. So CMS is proposing, following what NQF recommended, to combine them into one measure using the new name death among surgical patients. but they will report it, or at least they're proposing to report it, in two places in Hospital Compare under both topic areas, nursing sensitive care and the patient safety indicators. Now on slide six, CMS always puts in a discussion in the IPPS rule about the factors they use when they try to determine how to enhance and add to quality reporting, and they continue to mention that they want to seriously consider burden and hospital burden in the reporting. And so they're looking at different data sources of how they can get information for quality measurement that theoretically would not add additional burden to hospitals' workload. So they continue to talk about collecting data from registries as a potential source. Of course, if you're already submitting the data to the registry, that would be great. If you're not, it would be additional burden. But at least it wouldn't be burden that CMS is imposing. And the issue there for them is they have to figure out a mechanism to get the data from the registries. And that hasn't been developed yet. They had a fairly longer discussion on how to use EHRs as a source of clinical data. And they have, since last fall, been working with the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT to identify and harmonize standards for three data sets to allow those data sets to be reported directly from EHRs, and that's ED throughput, stroke, and VTE. And the ED throughput measures are around time, median time from entry into the ED to departure, or from the decision to admit to the actual departure from the ED, and the stroke and the VTE are more clinically rich. They would expect the process would go that they would the organization called HITSB, Health Information Technology Standards Panel, which develops standards for measures, would develop those standards, and then they would be posted publicly, and then the vendors could take those standards and incorporate them into the EHR products, and that would then allow, at least theoretically, allow hospitals to capture and report on these data sets via EHR. So in order to test this, CMS is going to select several vendors and hospital groups to test the data submission, and they're asking vendors and hospitals as well to self-nominate through the end of this calendar year. So before we go on to the next topic, I'm going to stop here and ask Danielle to provide some additional insight into how Premier is assessing the IPPS rule. And I also wanted to mention, I know Daniel will talk further on this, there were, as always, many measures that CMS talked about that they considered proposing for reporting and deferred for the following year, and one of those is a Premier measure. So, Daniel.
Great. Thanks, Nicole. Certainly, as you would anticipate, Premier is actively reviewing the inpatient rule, the quality section, as well as the entire rule. We are in the process of compiling a comment letter, and we will be sharing that with members probably around June 20th. The comments are due June 30th, so look out for that draft next month. Just to give you a sense of where we are on these issues, in terms of the quality section, we are certainly glad, as Nicole pointed out, CMS has drastically slowed down their process for both quality measures and hospital-acquired conditions. So it's clear that they listened to Premier's comments as well as those of the rest of the hospital field. We do support the harmonization of the two measures, as she outlined. That's actually something that you may recall on this call last year. I pointed out was something that we had recommended, and so we're glad that CMS is finally taking that step. We are also supportive of the new SCIP measures, And while we don't necessarily have a problem with the structural measures, the ones that ask you whether or not you participate in a registry, we are a bit concerned that does signal that CMS is moving forward with adopting registry-based measures in the future, not because of that we have a problem with the registries really themselves, but that if CMS endorses a particular proprietary set of measures from a registry, and that could basically set up a monopoly where hospitals would essentially have to pay to participate in those registries, whether they had been previously or not. So we're quite concerned with that, and we think that anything that's involved in federal public reporting of quality should be fully transparent, and those measures should be available to you all to calculate on your own without having to purchase the membership within a registry. We also think that really CMS should be focusing on this issue of getting the EHRs connected to CMS as opposed to figuring out how to have hospitals manually abstract data, give it to a registry, and then have the registry electronically connect with CMS. We are very supportive of their efforts to test the submission of data from the electronic health records to directly to CMS, and we really think that needs to be their focus going forward. As Nicole pointed out, Premier does have a measure up for the proposed 2012 measures. That's the complication index. CMS does not give you a whole lot of information on those measures, so it's very difficult to comment in that area, but certainly a number of them have been talked about previously and are very likely to come up next year. So that's a good place for you all to look at what's coming down the pike in terms of your workload and what will be expected of you in terms of reporting measures. The last thing I want to point out is actually not directly quality related, but it's a very important point that I think you all need to be aware of, and that is something that's called the behavioral offset in this year's rule, and that reduces payments in fiscal year 2010 by 1.9%. And what that is it's a reduction in payments to try to reverse an increase in payments to hospitals based on increased documentation and coding during the implementation of the new Medicare severity diagnosis-related groups. So the contention is here that hospitals were seeing increased payments due to coding, not due to actual changes in the acuity of their patients. So CMS is actually trying to recoup that money. That does total 8.5% over three fiscal years, 10, 11, and 12. So 8.5% of your Medicare payments, which is nationally about $8.5 billion. So this is really important to the bottom line of your hospitals and something that you should be aware of in this rule. And I think that's it, Nicole.
Great. Okay. We can then turn to our next topic. You'll see on slide 7, and that's an update on the Hospital Quality Alliance. So moving to slide 8, the Hospital Quality Alliance meets quarterly, and one of the things that they do at those meetings is they talk about measures that they would recommend that CMS include in the RACTAPU program for the inpatient side and the outpatient payment system for the outpatient side. And they also discuss other issues related to public reporting and quality measurement. So in the March meeting, they were already talking about outpatient measures for calendar year 2010 because the cycle is that CMS will be, or is probably already now, starting to write the rule that will become the proposed outpatient prospective payment system rule, usually gets released in July. So the Hospital Quality Alliance wanted to make recommendations to influence that rulemaking. And so they looked at a number of outpatient measures that CMS had signaled they were interested in incorporating, and they actually came back to the Hospital Quality Alliance group and didn't recommend any measures for reporting in calendar year 2010 on the outpatient side. They looked at the measures they looked at, the chart-based ones, they felt were not specified for the hospital outpatient setting. So, for example, they might have looked at outpatient measures that are used in the PQRI program, and there was the argument, well, there may be a difference when you transition from a physician office setting to a hospital outpatient setting that needs to be considered when you look at the measures. In other cases, they felt that the measures might be applicable to the outpatient setting, but they really haven't been adequately field tested, so nobody would really know if the measures reliably and validly measured what they set out to measure. In terms of other measures, they looked at some measures derived from registry data, and they weren't comfortable in recommending those because, again, as we discussed before, the data submission and validation process for measures derived from registry data haven't been developed and tested and shared, and so they felt uncomfortable recommending those measures. The larger HQA seemed perhaps a little disappointed with the recommendation and asked that they go back and look at the measures again. But the fact of the matter is that given where CMS is in their rulemaking process, by the time that the HQA can report out again, CMS most likely will have already written their rule, although it will not have been put forward publicly. One of the other things that was discussed at the HQA meeting that I wanted to bring up was the idea of putting composite measures for display on Hospital Compare. And the HQA itself has long supported that because they feel that having a composite measure, a summary measure, would make it easier for consumers to understand and compare different hospitals. And there was a discussion by various folks and CMS included about how to do this, and CMS reported that it does intend to implement composite measures, and those wouldn't be new measures, they would just be a composite of the existing measures, so there might be sort of an AMI composite measure for the AMI set or a heart failure one for the heart failure set. They said they would use a five-star type approach. And they could implement it as early as December 2009, but they didn't sound real confident when they said that. And they talked about different ways of developing the composites, and once they make that decision, I can share that with you. They'll put it out in a rule in the Federal Register to look at exactly how they're going to be combining those measures, and you might be able to get a sense of how that will reflect your hospital's performance. Danielle, is there anything you wanted to add about the HQA?
I don't think so. Should we go ahead and move on to the Senate Finance?
Sure.
Proposal then. So going to slide 10, let me just give you a 2 seconds worth of context here. Obviously, as I'm sure you've seen in the papers, health reform debate is very active at the moment here in D.C., and there are a lot of different players in the House and the Senate who are getting proposals together. The Senate Finance Committee has come out with a series of three options papers related to delivery system reform is one, coverage is the second, and financing, or basically how to pay for all of this, is the third. And each of those has had associated comment periods that a number of your hospitals, I'm sure, have responded to through comments to the Senate Finance Committee. But we wanted to just run through a couple of the pieces that are in those proposals because that's basically the starting point for the debate right now of what's in those. So certainly things will change by the time, this will pass or likely will pass. You have to ask the political pundits in terms of whether or not this will get done by the end of the year. But the goal is to have this passed in August, but certainly that might slip later. So specifically what we want to focus on here today are the proposals that are basically the nexus of cost and quality. Certainly the one of the reasons that this is included in these proposals is because the Senate Finance Committee has to find areas that they can safely reduce costs so that they can use those savings to pay for an expansion of coverage. So that's pretty much the political environment here. If we want to go to slide 11, we'll give you a little bit of detail. First up is the value-based purchasing proposal. And that is, in many ways, very similar to the principles that the hospital community has agreed to. But there are a few key areas where it is very different. In particular, I want to point out to you that the way this is structured, the money at stake for your hospital in 2013, which is the first year of payment, is 2% of your Medicare payments. But it goes up to 5% of your Medicare payments in 2016. So that's a pretty substantial amount at stake based on how you score on your quality measures. The second piece that's quite troublesome is that the bottom quartile of performers receive none of that money back. So if they're withheld 5%, then they lose all 5%, and that money goes back to the Medicare Trust Fund. That money is not, for instance, put back into the base somehow or redistributed to higher performers. It is simply savings to the government. It is one of the areas that Congress would be able to say they're saving money and thus count that money towards some other policy they want to implement that costs money. So that's our biggest problem here, is that it is used as deficit reduction when we believe that you need to start off with a program where everyone has the opportunity to get above a threshold and earn at least part of their withhold back. On the good news, though, it does both recognize quality improvement, quality attainment and quality improvement. That was something that we changed from the beginning of our HQID demonstration to the extension of it, is the addition of the quality improvement, and so that is good news. Lastly, it does put a placeholder for testing value-based purchasing with critical access hospitals, which, as you know, have been exempt from quality reporting thus far, although I think about half of them do it voluntarily, but they have not been included in any of the value-based purchasing legislation thus far, other than to start testing how you would pay in that situation, because they are exempt from the inpatient PPS and are cost-based providers. So if there are any critical access hospitals out there, this will likely be coming your way sometime soon as well. On the next slide, we talk about hospital readmissions. And the way this starts off is in 2010, CMS begins calculating readmission rates. Now, obviously, there are some readmission rates that they are already in the process of collecting and getting up on Hospital Compare. So it's a little unclear how this would jive with the existing program, but there may be different measures, for instance, that they begin to calculate in 2010 based on this legislation. And in 2011, that data would go back to the provider, so you would have some sense of where you fare compared to your peers. In 2013 is when there would be a payment reduction, And the way that would be determined is if in 2012 your facility was in the top quartile or having the most readmissions for eight selected conditions, then basically you would be, I don't want to say eligible because that sounds positive, but you would be subject to a payment withhold of 20% of those DRGs in the next year. So CMS would hold on to 20% of your payments for certain DRGs for 30 days, and if that patient returned to the hospital, the government would keep that 20%. If the patient did not come back to the hospital and they were not readmitted, then you would have that 20% restored to you. So this, unfortunately, is a case-by-case cut. It's not something that we support. We think that readmission should be looked at on a risk-adjusted, rate-based measure integrated into value-based purchasing where you have both carrots and sticks instead of just a case-by-case cut. So this is not a preferred approach, although we are working with the hospital field on a different way to go about this. If this is indeed where Congress wants to go, to make sure that they're not holding on to a significant amount of your cash, basically, for 30 days at a time. So certainly expect more readmission-related measures coming up in the near future. On the next slide, in terms of the bundling policy options, and these, by the way, all of these options we're talking about here today, while they're in detail in the Senate Finance proposal, these are also issues that the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission has looked at. The Congressional Budget Office has included in their options papers. So we've really only included in here policy areas that we believe are very, very likely to end up in some sort of final bill. So that's why we think these are areas you really need to start thinking about. So in terms of the bundling, what that would do, you can see the little equation on the slide. It would basically pay hospitals what they are currently being paid for their DRG plus what is assumed to be an average of the post-acute care payments. Then you have an allowance for appropriate readmissions, those that are planned, for instance, and then potentially an adjustment for efficiencies, which basically means a way to cut your payments over time. So it would be, as this points out, hospital and post-acute care. This does not include physicians, and that's part of our concern here is how, since physicians are the ones who admit and discharge and order post-acute care, et cetera, how they will be part of this and how their measures will be aligned with ours to make sure that the incentives are consistent across the various areas. So this is something that we think is an important type of policy to consider, but it needs really significant testing before this can go forward. The Senate Finance has this envisioned beginning in 2015 and having all DRGs rolled into this payment mechanism by 2019, which we think is really quite ambitious, especially since we do not have quality measures yet that cross that go across the payment silos where we can really make sure that all of the providers involved in care are appropriately held accountable. The last thing we want to cover on the next slide is comparative effectiveness. And this proposal talks about establishing a framework to set national priorities. And you can see some of those here in terms of what really works in healthcare, supporting transparency, making sure that there are patient safeguards, et cetera. I will point out that I think it was yesterday, might have been today, sometime very recently, HHS has a comparative effectiveness research council, a federal coordinating council that was created after the ARRA bill, which is the stimulus funding bill. and they came out with draft prioritization criteria for comparative effectiveness research related to the potential impact in terms of, you know, things like disease burden. Comparative effectiveness as it relates to certain diverse populations and patient subpopulations, uncertainty within clinical and public health communities regarding management decisions, addressing the gaps in research and funding, and then also the multiplicative effect. So, you know, does this set us up for additional research in the future? So that council is moving ahead, and we do expect that there'll be something in this final bill that sort of builds on what this coordinating council is already doing. The one last thing I will point out that's not in the slides is that since we last spoke, the president's budget was also released May 7th, actually, the 2010 budget, and that does have $635 billion in it as a reserve fund to pay for health reform over 10 years. And the reason I point this out is that almost half of that reserve fund is created from Medicare and Medicaid savings, which you should read as reductions in payments to hospitals. So the three important pieces there is they do have a readmissions policy that would reduce payments by $8 billion. A value-based purchasing policy that would reduce payments by $12 billion, and then a hospital post-acute care bundling that would reduce payments by $17 billion all over 10 years. So, again, you're seeing the same themes played out in the president's budget. So you will be hearing more from us over the next couple months as health reform progresses, and certainly we will continue to need the help of our members to comment to Congress and encourage them to make changes that are beneficial to our membership. So I think, Nicole, we're back to you.
Okay. And we're going to just talk a little bit more about meaningful use. It's going to be a topic that we'll probably be talking about throughout this year as the definition of meaningful use starts to get narrowed down to something that actually looks like something you can understand and use as guidance as you assess either EHR purchases or enhancements and upgrades. So on slide 16 and then behind it on 17, we have slides from the last presentation that just summarize some of the key points about meaningful use and how those were talked about in the stimulus bill. So just to review those at a really high level, the way it's proposed to work is that payments both under Medicaid and Medicare could be increased based on hospitals being meaningful users and physicians and other professional providers as well being meaningful users of health IT. And for hospitals, the incentive payments are estimated to be as high as $11 million per hospital over a four-year period. And the criteria are fairly loose. So what the bill says is that meaningful users have to use certified EHR technology connected in a manner that provides for electronic exchange of health information, and that's for the purpose of improving quality of care. The second criterion is using certified EHR technology to report on clinical quality measures that are not specified. They will be selected by the HHS secretary, and preference are going to be given to measures. In the bill, it says endorsed by an entity that does this and that, which is essentially NQF. And then it notes that the secretary has to have the capacity to accept quality measure information electronically. So the carrot is the money that they will give out. The stick is that under the Medicare plan, hospitals that are not meaningful users by 2015 will see reductions to a percentage of their market basket updates. And on slide 17, kind of runs through the similar thing for providers, and you'll just note, obviously, the dollar amounts are a little bit lower that they're eligible for, and also they have one additional criterion, which is that to be a meaningful user, they have to use a certified EHR that includes the use of e-prescribing. But obviously, this is quite high level. I mean, what do they mean by certified EHR technology? What are the quality measures? What kind of exchange of information has to go on? You know, can you just exchange information if you're an integrated network or an integrated system, you know, from one hospital in your system to some outpatient facility within your system? Is that enough? Do you have to do it to an external entity? All these things aren't defined. So you kind of got come up to slide 18, which is, okay, great, so what is meaningful use? And so what the ARA says is that the Secretary of Health and Human Services is going to define meaningful use. So we are going to be going over through these presentations, and obviously it'll be in the news and elsewhere, as some of these things get narrowed down. So what's happened to date, the HHS has started working on an infrastructure to answer this question. They've named two committees that were specified in the Recovery Act, a Health IT Policy Committee and a Health IT Standards Committee. And the Health IT Policy Committee, as one of its main charges and priorities, is going to look at this issue of meaningful use. They also have an internal HHS work group with individuals from various agencies and part of HHS that's also working on the definition. The other thing that is clear is the timing. There will be interim guidance by the end of the calendar year as to what meaningful use is. So while they're figuring out the structure, and I'm sure they're talking about some of what the specifics are, there are groups that are stepping into the void to propose various definitions of meaningful use. And on slide 19, we've summarized some of those. And some of this information was from a two-day hearing that the National Center for Vital Health Statistics held at the end of April, where they invited a series of different groups and people to testify on various aspects of meaningful use. So not going to read through all of these, but the Markle Foundation, for example, was talking about meaningful use should not just be limited to a comprehensive EHR. You ought to look at other types of technology that can accomplish the same purposes and not focus so much on the type of technology. The other thing that the Markle Foundation suggested was that this is a definition that needs to expand over time. You know, start with clinical information that you can that hospitals and physicians can currently collect and exchange. Things like medication histories, test results that are most commonly already contained in electronic form. They also pointed out that they didn't want to penalize providers that had already made an investment. Don't specify things that folks that jumped in early would be disadvantaged because they would not be able to accomplish that with the level of EHR that they have. AMIA is the American Medical Informatics Association. You'll start to see some overlap in some of the things that these different organizations are saying. They also felt that this is a definition that needs to change over time. What you start with in the first year of meaningful use, 2011, will not necessarily be your ultimate goal, but you need to make it realistic so that some folks get the money. You can't set the bar so high that no entity would get the money in the incentives, but you can't set it so low that everybody gets it. So it's that balancing act. They talk about meaningful use resulting not only in better care to an individual patient, but also improvement in population health. And they actually went ahead and specified some things they thought EHR should be able to do that you can see there. And then finally, HIMSS, Healthcare Information and Management Systems Society, probably came out with the most specific and detailed definition of meaningful use. But if you actually look at that, even that you'll see is not enough to specifically be guidance in terms of looking at what a hospital or a physician's office would need if they were investing in it. But they were more specific. And they talked about phasing it in two-year increments and becoming increasingly stringent. And so in phase one, which would start in 2011, they just, you know, said, let's start with requiring lab, pharmacy, and radiology and a clinical data repository. And then they talked about collecting baseline reporting of metrics such as readmissions within 24 hours of discharge, maybe electronic reporting of Joint Commission core measures, percentage of medical orders entered electronically into the EHR by physicians. And then in phase two, which would then by their standards start in 2013, then they would get more stringent with some of those quality metrics. So instead of just looking at the percentage of medical orders entered, make it that 51% or more have to be entered by CPOE. So you can see how they're doing their electronic prescribing to external pharmacies. So they're starting to be more specific and prescriptive. And that would follow through their third phase, which would begin in 2015. So there were many other entities that provided very interesting commentary that you can look at. But obviously, this is a continuing dialogue, and we're going to continue to go around and around, and slowly it'll get more specific as some of these ideas are floated and tested. And on slide 20, we just tried to, at least from the things we had read, kind of bring out some highlights. We saw areas of commonality. Again, it's focusing on the actual use of technology to improve health outcomes. Let's look at what we're trying to accomplish rather than specify certain things about the technology, which is just a tool to get there. This idea of phasing in requirements, which makes sense from several points of view because it would accommodate the current state of technology and current level of adoption, and then it also would allow for an end goal that is more stringent, and then implementing requirements that could benefit both individuals and population health. And finally, having an ultimate focus on clinical rather than administrative data for automated quality reporting, but recognizing that in those first years, the level of adoption and the depth of adoption may be such that you can't start with complex measures that require complex clinical data to be transmitted. And now I just wanted to check in with Danielle to see if she has additional comment and information about how Premier is contributing to the national debate on meaningful use.
Thanks, Nicole. I think that you all are aware of this, but for those of you who did not hear this on a previous call, Premier has created a health information technology collaborative for our members. And it basically is providing members with very practical information on qualifying for the electronic health record, financial incentives that Nicole talked about, as well as establishing electronic health information exchange networks in their communities. And so it's a forum, it's a place to, it's a way to receive information, to discuss and share best practices. There's a website, communities.premierinc.com, and you can register to participate there. And there's a lot of information up on that website. And as I said, it is also a two-way website where folks can post things and download things and a little bit of a blog function, etc. So there's a lot of good information up there for those of you who are interested, and it is a free service for members. There's no fee to participate. It is a group that we expect will be taking policy positions. However, in terms of the definition of meaningful use, we have found that there's quite a bit of disparate views among the membership right now in terms of how that should be defined. So really, the tact we've taken thus far is to provide information similar to what Nicole went through up on this website, where a lot of the different proposals of the definition of meaningful use are housed, and you can peruse those as you wish. So I urge you all, if this is an area that you're interested in, to work with your CIO, who's likely already part of this, or register for our website and take a look. So with that, May, I think we're ready to take questions if you want to remind folks how they can get themselves in the queue.
At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from the line of Jackie Gish.
Hello. My question has to do with the readmission piece. What is the definition of post-acute? Is it skilled nursing? Is it home health? Is it subacute? Is it all of the above?
Sure. In the way these proposals are looking at it is a readmission policy would be in place until a bundling policy comes into play. And in terms of what would be included in that in post-acute care world, the expectation is that it would be home health, skilled nursing facilities, inpatient rehab, and long-term care hospitals. So basically, the distinction, which is not the easiest to wrap your head around, is really the other Medicare payment systems. You know, because you have to remember that you know, if Medicaid, for instance, is paying for someone in a nursing home, it wouldn't be part of this policy. It's only where Medicare pays for that patient that the payments would be combined. So just be careful there that you don't, you know, you have to pay attention in terms of subacute SNF units and such, that you're just capturing the Medicare patients and payments in your consideration of how things would be bundled together.
And then is the expectation that the hospital and the whatever, the skilled nursing facility, then figure out payment from there?
Indeed. The general expectation is that the money would likely go to the hospital, although the post-acute care providers and the hospital could create a separate entity to receive the money. But basically, the hospitals would have to begin negotiating to pay all of those provider types that have traditionally gone straight to Medicare to get their payment.
Wow, great. Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Your next question comes from the line of Steve Durbin.
Greetings. Hi, Nicole. Hi, Daniel. My question is about slide 12 on the readmissions, preventable readmissions, and wondering if there's any new clues about how they would measure preventable readmissions for purpose of that. Earlier, they were looking at the 3M metric, but also, I guess, behind that question, hoping that they won't use the current CMS 30-day metric, which is kind of an odd duck of a measure.
It's a very good question and something that is being actively debated. The 3M product, potentially preventable readmission product, is something that we're not particularly comfortable with. It really measures more whether or not something is potentially related than potentially preventable. It looks at if you came in for heart failure and initially and you came back for heart failure, okay, that's very possibly related, right? If you came in for heart failure and you came back for appendicitis, probably not related. So that's really the assessment it makes. The potentially preventable is a little bit misleading, I'd say. We Premier are also working on our own risk-adjusted readmission measure that we're hoping to have available at later this year. But certainly it is not easy to predict what is, quote, preventable. So to some extent, that's why we have recommended that this shouldn't be applied on a case-by-case basis, because you can't tell in any individual situation if something was preventable. It's best to look at this across a population and use a risk adjustment tool, you know, across the hospitals, you know, total universe of patients in that area, rather than look at each individual case. So it's not something that we have an easy answer to or an easy fix to, but it's certainly something we're concerned about and looking to try to improve.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Michelle Mahan.
Yes, I just was wondering when you were talking about the Health Information Technology Collaborative, you said there was a way to sign up that you stated a web address. I was wondering if you could repeat that.
Sure. It's HTTPS, you know, the colon,
yeah,
backslash, normal stuff, communities.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no www. It's
okay.
communities.premierinc.com.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And then you'll have to, there'll be a registration help question there, because obviously you guys don't have passwords yet.
Okay. Appreciate that.
No problem.
Your next question comes from the line of Mary Panico.
I think both of my questions were actually answered already. Just one question I do have. So when we're talking about 30-day readmission, we're actually talking about all types of readmissions, or are we looking at related readmissions for specific case types?
Well, you know, a couple things. So first of all, this particular policy would start out with 8 particular DRGs. So it would be sort of disease state specific. We are trying to push and we are trying to develop a related readmission measure. Right now, as the other caller, Steve, pointed out, there's only all cause measures. So we're not to the point where we have available to us a related measure.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Ann Jacob.
Yes. Back to the post-acute care discussion, would that payment also include medications for those that Medicare would cover?
You know, that's a fair question. If it's, I'm trying to remember back to my post-acute care payment days. If it's something that is included in the normal payment for post-acute care, so long-term care hospitals, for instance, they have a case rate. They have a single payment that's like a DRG. And in that case, everything you provide that patient is all rolled up into that payment. So you would assume that same bundle of services within this payment construct. So I can't think of a situation, I'll give you an example of where your point may be very instructive. Let's say a person is on home health care, right? Their drugs that are normally paid for under the Part D benefit, that would not come into play here because the Part D benefit is still separate. It's only the Part A and Part B pieces that we're talking about here. So it's a good point that they're, depending on which post-acute care setting you're in, the drugs may be in or out of that bundle.
Thank you.
No problem.
There are no further questions in the queue.
Okay, then. This is Kathy. I guess we can wrap up. It's a few minutes before 4. And thank you, everyone, for joining and participating. And have a great rest of your week.
Thank you for your participation. This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect at this time.